Major League Baseball has changed dramatically since the book Moneyball was published. Data drives nearly every decision that every team makes. This week on Techonomics, host Jason Middleton talks with an author who has penned what is basically a sequel to Moneyball. And that starts now.
Hello and welcome back, and thanks for listening. It's mid-December, dipping temperatures, holiday shopping, and 2 months until pitchers and catchers report for MLB's spring training. Baseball fans call it the hot stove season. It's when teams retool their rosters for the coming baseball season. It's when trades are made and contracts are signed. And what fuels those decisions? Data. Lots of data.
And then, of course, the Astros probably best epitomize the evolution in those 15 years since then. The Astros do everything the A's were doing times a million. And it was just a happenstance that the Astros wound up winning the World Series because we chose the game in late September, so we knew they were in the playoffs.
This week, we have the author of Powerball, Anatomy of a Modern Baseball Game. Each half inning of one game gets a chapter of analysis and crisp writing. Okay, let's get to it.
I'm Rob Nyer. I am a baseball writer, author, and I've got a new book.
Yes, you do, and it's called Powerball, and we're going to get into it. But first, I have to do a complete transparency here. I'm a longtime reader and a fan.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
When I got the chance to interview you, and especially about my favorite sport, and especially about your history, I couldn't pass it up. So thank you for your time.
Oh, my pleasure.
The book is called Powerball, Anatomy of a Modern Baseball Game. By my count, this is your seventh title. Is that about right?
That's right.
In the hot stove season, I read baseball books to keep me going until spring training. And I recently read Nine Innings. I think it was published back in 1982. Are you familiar with that one?
Oh, sure. I was a huge fan when that book came out. And in fact, the way this book came together was an editor out of the blue came to me and said, Rob, I would love for someone to write a modern day Nine Innings. And having been a fan of the book, having read it probably three or four times, I was immediately intrigued.
I bet. And given your history, and we're going to get into that, but given your history, this book is almost an instant classic, and I don't think I'm overstating that.
I sure hope so. I mean, we all sort of dream of being in print forever and having people pick it up in 20 years and think it's still relevant.
A sense of immortality.
Right.
Rob, let's talk about your background. You worked with Bill James, right? And you are an early data pioneer. Can you give us a little bit of your bio so we can then talk about the book?
Growing up, I was just your typical rabid kid sports fan. I loved basketball and football and baseball, and I particularly loved the Kansas City Royals. I grew up there. I was there in the late 70s when they had these great teams that were competitive every season, went to the World Series in 1980, et cetera. So I just loved the game, was obsessed with sports, and especially the Royals. When I went to college, for the first time, I saw day one, basically, I happened to be in the bookstore and saw my first Bill James baseball abstract. I picked it up, was immediately intrigued, and knew this was something I'd never seen before, and I knew that it was for me. And I just became the biggest Bill James fan in the world, basically. And then four and a half years later, I was somehow lucked into a job working for Bill, which was literally my dream job. When people ask, what do you want to do with your life? If they asked me that, I would say, well, I want to work for Bill James. But I had no idea how to make that happen.
Right.
And then I just sort of fell into it.
That's amazing. Your new book, Powerball, Anatomy of a Modern Baseball Game, is kind of a graduation ceremony from Moneyball in a lot of ways, especially if you think about the Oakland A's aspect of it. Can you tell us how you came to choose a game on September the 8th, 2017, to elucidate your take on the modern baseball game?
My editor and I, we wanted a game that had all, or it turned out, most of the elements in high relief of the modern game, which of course is typified by power pitching and power hitting, and hence the title.
Right.
We also wanted a game with some big twists and turns, some real moves in that win expectancy graph that I write a little bit about in the book.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a number of games to choose from, but this A's Astros game was, you know, seemed like a natural because it gave me the entree into Moneyball and writing about that. And hard to believe it's been 15 years now since the book came out.
I know, right?
And then, you know, the A's clearly epitomized the nascent movement toward a lot more data and looking at the numbers, making your decisions based on that, the objective instead of the subjective. And, of course, all that's been overblown to some degree, you know, the way it happened back then. But it was a real thing.
Right.
And had a huge influence. And then, of course, the Astros probably best epitomize the evolution in those 15 years since then. The Astros do everything the A's were doing times a million. And it was just a happy happenstance that the Astros wound up winning the World Series, because we chose the game in late September, so we knew they were in the playoffs,
right?
Didn't know they would win the World Series.
Well, that was a quick turnaround then. If you just picked that game at the end of September, you pushed this out pretty quickly, so this must have been top of mind for you.
From conception of book late September to delivering the manuscript, I think it was either May 31 or June 1, was about what? 9 months, which is very quick for a book like this.
Sure is. It's a great turnaround time. And obviously top of list for this year's hot stove season. I'm going to ask you to pick your favorite child in a minute when I talk about metrics, but I want to ask you about the concept of power losing. I really like the way you kind of pulled this one out a little bit. Let's talk about the evolution of that, because that seems to be something within the past 15 years from Moneyball to your book, Powerball. Let's talk about power losing. Can you unpack it for us?
Well, sure. It's really more about transparency. In the old days, teams would often go into a rebuilding process, or they would never even bother trying to rebuild. They just didn't bother trying to compete. People think about the golden age of baseball, for example, in the 1950s. It's called that all the time. Well, yes, there were a lot of wonderful things happening, but there was also the fact that basically a New York team won the World Series every year. And with many of the teams in the majors not really competing. Now, they were trying to compete, but realistically, they didn't have the money. They didn't have the personnel. They really weren't going to compete. But they would tell their fans every spring, this is the year.
Oh, anything can happen, right? Yeah.
Anything can happen. It's just that hardly anything ever did happen.
Right.
Now, that in the 1980s, that equation did change quite a bit when you had the 1980s was the most competitive era in Major League history, and I think it was great in the 80s. Somebody different won every year. Because the money was sort of balanced, anybody could compete. The Kansas City Royals had the highest payroll in the majors in, I believe it was 1989 or 1990. So, and they were the smallest market, or one of the very smallest markets. Mm-hmm. But, of course, that went away a few years later, and then you saw this huge stratification in payrolls. And that's where we're at now. What teams are doing now is saying, you know what, we're not even going to make any pretense. We're not going to tell you during spring training that this could be the year. Anything could happen. Look at our roster. It's not going to happen. We don't have the talent.
Right.
And it's much easier for everyone, the media, the fans, to look at a roster in March and say, or April, and say, this team is not a 90-win team. It's a 60-70-win team. You know, back in the 50s, nobody knew. You could make some guesses, but you couldn't quantify these things. Now you can quantify everything. Mm. So with a fair degree of certainty, and not complete, but you can tell whether a team has a shot at the playoffs. Now, every year someone will surprise us, but we're not as surprised as we used to be because we're a lot smarter than we used to be. So now you've got teams like the Cubs and then the Astros basically telling the world, no, we're not going to compete. We're not going to spend what it would take to be competitive. It doesn't seem like a good use of our resources. And it's perfectly rational. It does drive fans away, at least in the short term, and that's one of the reasons why we saw a 4% drop in attendance this season.
Mm. We're speaking with Rob Nyer, a veteran baseball writer and the author of his newest book, Powerball, Anatomy of a Modern Baseball Game. Okay, at the top you mentioned power pitching, power hitting. I admit that I am a Dodgers fan. I watch Chris Taylor swing the bat, and I can't imagine that Ted Williams is okay with that. What importance does launch angle have in today's game?
It has a great deal, and I will say that Ted Williams was actually way ahead of his time. If you go back and look at the book that he published, late 60s, early 70s, he was preaching launch angle. What's really interesting is that even though his book is, I would almost certainly, the best-selling book about hitting ever published, maybe it might have sold more copies than all the others combined, there has still been, in the decades since, you know, innumerable hitting coaches and youth coaches, which is a different story, but certainly major league hitting coaches, professional hitting coaches, preaching swinging down on the ball or having a level swing. And what Williams always said was, no, you should uppercut the ball. That's where the money is. That's where the power is. Hmm. You want to hit the ball out of the ballpark, you've got to uppercut. And he would also make the point that the ball is coming toward you on a downward plane because the pitcher is above you, mm-hmm. right on the mound.
Right.
Your best chance at making solid contact is a slight uppercut. And now that they can measure that launch angle, what happens when you can quantify things is then you can convince people. It's one thing to say, do what Ted Williams did, but somebody else can say, well, that doesn't work. What was always said was it works for Ted Williams, but not for anybody else, or not for almost everybody else.
Right.
But when you get the actual numbers and can quantify things, that's when you start convincing people that something works. And more now, players are, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, no players bought into this stuff. They thought it was a joke. And now you go around baseball and talk to these guys, and most players buy into the analytics. They grew up with it. It was in the stories they read as kids. Their college coaches preached it. Their minor league coaches. It's just a part of baseball now. So, and if you're not using them, you can still be successful. Some players do or are, but it is more difficult.
Is there something else that's being measured and being proven to work, and pitchers are following it?
There is. I mean, it's not as prevalent. It's not as easy for people to sort of change. But pitchers are looking at something now called effective velocity, which is basically the idea that, just to name one example, every 90-mile-an-hour fastball is not the same. Mm-hmm. A low one without a high spin rate doesn't look as fast as a high one with a high spin rate. And that's what Brent Strom, who's quoted in the book a few times, that's what he's been preaching for years. And the Astros, he's the pitching coach for the Astros, they have really taken this to heart. He's preached that throughout the organization. Yes, they do have pitchers who throw hard, no question. They don't have the hardest throwers, but their fastballs are incredibly effective because they throw them high with these high spin rates, and they look faster than they are. In fact, this is an amazing thing. The Astros minor league teams led their leagues in strikeouts. Every single one of them did. So that's the future. Every team is going to be following the Astros' lead. I'm sure many of them already are, but every team is going to be. And that's because now we can measure. It was in the old days when in the 1970s, Tom Seaver was preaching the same thing, and Brent Strom was listening. But it wasn't until you could actually quantify this sort of thing that you can really – people are going to be resistant to change. But when you can show them the numbers,
right,
show them something works – they still might not change, but they're more amenable to it.
Yeah, data-based decision-making. We're kind of big on that here in Silicon Valley.
Yep.
Let me ask just a quick non sequitur, almost a sideways question. Is the lower spin rate the definition of a heavy ball, of a pitcher throwing a heavy ball?
I don't know. I don't know the physics of the heavy ball. There's so much out there right now. I actually have bookmarked someplace an article on the physics of the heavy ball, but I haven't read it yet.
So all right, cool.
It's funny, though, but I do know that historically the heavy ball was associated with sinkers, right?
Yeah.
And, low fastballs, typically sinkers. And Brent Strom hates sinkers. And so I don't know why. You'd think that a high-spin sinker would work pretty well. And, in fact, Blake Treinen with the A's had a tremendous season throwing a one-seam sinker that's very heavy and also moves a lot, which is the real key to it.
Right, right. Once again, speaking with Rob Nyer, veteran baseball writer, and his newest book, Powerball: Anatomy of a Modern Baseball Game, I'd like to keep you just for a couple more minutes to ask you some macro baseball questions. I can't miss my opportunity. Is that okay?
Sure.
All right. The reports are the A's believe that the Astros were stealing signs during late August game. Isn't stealing signs something that just is in baseball?
Well, it certainly has been. We have incidents going back to the, I don't know, the 100 years,
right,
more than 100 years.
Well, we had the Bobby Thompson home run.
Even before that, there was a famous story in the 1900s about a wire under the dirt that connected to a buzzer under the feet of a base coach. So these things have been going on forever. There has traditionally been a sort of agreement that you wouldn't use electronics. It's one thing to peer in over the, or a telescope, as happened in 1951 with those Giants. It's one thing to stand someplace and look and watch and do what you can. But when you introduce electronics or a telescope or whatever, walkie-talkies, that's considered inappropriate at best. The rules have always been hazy, but it's just not something you're supposed to do. Players have been suspended for it. Teams have been fined. In 2017, the Red Sox were caught using an Apple Watch to relay signs from behind the dugout. So you're not supposed to do it. You're certainly not supposed to misrepresent yourself, your identity. You're not supposed to use electronics. You're not supposed to send things via messages. So whatever they did, or I should say, if they did it,
right,
it was against the rules, and they're going to face some punishment.
Yeah, I don't know if there's fire there either, but boy, there's a lot of smoke. You've got smoke coming from the A's, from the Red Sox, and the Dodgers when it comes to Astros.
Absolutely, and I suspect the Astros are going to face some punishment, whether it's a fine or something else, I don't know, but it doesn't look good.
Okay, Rob, last question for you. I know you got to go. I had a guest on recently who wrote a book called Salary Caps and the Franchise Model. His argument is the free market could radically change the product on the field, and he was talking about regulation and promotion, kind of like the European soccer leagues do.
Right.
What do you have a take on salary caps in baseball?
Well, I do. I think there's already a de facto salary cap because of the various revenue sharing and luxury tax and things like that. So you've seen teams, the Yankees in particular, have spent way less than they could have the last few years because they didn't want to go over that cap and have to pay extra money into the kitty. And other teams have done the same thing. So the big market teams, the big money teams, have spent less than they had. To some degree, teams are able to have realized that spending all that extra money that they could have spent wouldn't really have led them many more wins because it's just hard to buy a lot of wins on the open market. There aren't that many good players on the free market every winter. So it's partly that, but it's partly they just don't like it. It offends their sensibility. It's psychologically difficult for them to pay 40 or 50 million bucks extra for nothing except for the right to spend over the cap, essentially.
Right.
Look, they're wealthy people, and it offends them to have to pay extra. So they want to stay under that cap and not pay the luxury tax, et cetera. I don't think any of that's going away. They'll just keep raising it every few years because the players are, players don't like the salary. What's a de facto salary cap?
Yeah.
Because it does, to some degree, it inhibits their salaries. I don't think we're going to see radical changes, though. I really don't. I think, for the most part, everybody's swimming in money, so it's hard to complain too much. And I know that last winter, you had a lot of baseball writers anyway and a few player agents who seemed to think that some sort of labor war was imminent, even though the current agreement lasts for another 3 or 4 years, because a few free agents, top guys, Mike Moustakas comes to mind, Jake Arrieta, didn't get the money that their agents said they would get. Hmm. Well, the fact of the matter is teams have just decided they don't want to spend the money they used to spend on players in the decline phases of their careers. There was no collusion.
Right.
And sure, 5 years ago, these guys would have gotten a lot more money. But it goes back to what we're quantifying now. And teams don't want to be stuck with bad contracts. I do think we're going to see some structural changes. The trick is the players want to make sure they get X percentage of the revenues.
Right.
They've always gotten around 50%. And it's still around 50%. If it starts to fall much below that, then we have some issues. But right now, we don't yet.
One example that occurred to me when I was listening to your answer would be Verlander is an example of somebody picking up, getting a pitching coach like Strom and then actually improving his game on the downside of his career. That's an interesting take. But then you look at Moustakas, like you pointed out, and that's a diminishing reward right there.
Most players are. If you go back and look at and I've done this many times, you look at the history of the 6, 7, 8 year contracts given to players in their 30s. In almost every single case, the team regretted those deals within 4 or 5 years. Albert Pujols is the best example of that, but there are many others. And it took a long time for that to seep in, for everybody to get it. But I think almost everybody does get it now. We're just not going to see those deals anymore.
Rob Nyer, thank you so much for your time this morning. This has truly been an honor. I've been a longtime reader of yours, and I can't wait to finish this book, Powerball, Anatomy of a Modern Baseball Game. Thanks again.
Oh, my pleasure, and love to do it again someday.
That was Rob Nyer, veteran baseball writer and sabermetrics pioneer. His new book is Powerball, Anatomy of a Modern Baseball Game. For links to Rob's work, including the book, please hit the show notes for this week. It's at kgoradio.com. Powerball lends one chapter to each half inning of one game between the Oakland A's and the Houston Astros from September of 2017, just a month before the Astros beat the L.A. Dodgers in Game 7 to win the World Series. And man, as a Dodgers fan, it is still hard to write and say those words.